on air, online, on digital, and the ABC Listen app. The Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
And today, the latest cohort of agriculture students graduate in Launceston.
There's a job in ag for everyone. I personally had no idea at the end of Grade 12 that I would be going into agriculture. Agriculture needs people in all areas, whether it be business, research, banking, yeah, lots of different things. So we need those people, and we need more smart young people coming into ag.
And a well-known Tasmanian soil expert inspires a world-renowned Canadian market gardener.
I had read Bill Mollison, the Permaculture Principle book. Bill Mollison being famous Tasman. I hope he has a statue or something here, but he's changed the lives of so many because he was the first one to introduce the idea of design in farming.
Yeah, today we meet the market gardener who has 3 million followers across the world on social media. He was in Tasmania this week to talk to small producers about making the most of their farms. They had the privilege of meeting with J.M. Fortier and chatting about his life on the farm in Canada. G'day, Tony Briscoe with you on this Friday, where in just a moment we'll hear from a couple of ag students who yesterday graduated from their course in Launceston. Also, coming up today, Richard Bailey will have all the details from the latest store cattle sale at Powrenna, the last one of the year, and what the lamb, sheep and cattle markets are doing on the mainland. We'll check in with the Bureau, the latest on the weather, in around about 10 minutes from now, and we'll reveal more details about changes to the BOM website. Plus, you can join in the program with your thoughts via that text line. 0438 922 936 is that number. Well, the first cohort of Bachelor of Agriculture Science students at the University of Tasmania have graduated in Launceston. The face-to-face course has been offered in the city since 2023. 80% of the graduates already have jobs lined up in the industry. Larissa Smith caught up with a couple of them.
Hi, I'm Bronte LeGros, and I've just completed my Bachelor of Agricultural Science at UTAS.
Congratulations. How do you feel?
Very excited to go for the next chapter.
Yeah, big relief.
Oh, yes, it's been a great journey. Been working in the industry while also studying, so which has been amazing. Yeah.
Why did you decide to study a Bachelor of Ag Science?
After school, I had absolutely no idea what I wanted to do, and I ended up taking a gap year, and I worked at XLD full-time for a year managing their operations and logistics, which ultimately led me studying agriculture and being really passionate about the agribusiness side of agriculture.
So you kind of had a bit of a background going into doing your degree. You weren't flying blind.
Yes, I did. I had lots of support from my mentors in the industry, and also growing up as well in the agricultural communities really helped.
What are your plans now that you've finished your course?
I've recently accepted an offer from Rabobank on their country banking graduate program, and I'll be moving to Melbourne for my first 6-month rotation.
Wow! So what will that graduate program involve?
So I'm starting as a credit analyst, and a lot of that will be running the numbers and seeing where things are at for farmers to help them ultimately. And then my next rotation will be as a relationship analyst, so spending a lot more time on farm and seeing how the farmers are going and what support we can offer. I still need to learn a lot more about the role, so don't know too much yet really.
But I guess it will help you to open your eyes up to different industries and different commodities that you could potentially specialise in?
Yes, definitely. I mean, I've only really been across the grains industry while studying and working, so it'd be great to see some more different industries and meet different people and really make those connections as well.
What did you enjoy most about this course that you've completed and graduating here in Launceston?
All the lecturers have been extremely passionate about what they've been teaching, and they're so willing to give up their time to help you as well and get involved in projects and also the practical side and the field trips. It's been lots of things in person, which has been great. And
was it more hands-on than what you expected in terms of field work versus theoretical?
It was different from year to year. So first year, you spent a lot more time in the lab doing the practical side of things, like looking down microscopes and things, whereas now in third year we spent a lot more time getting out to properties and actually seeing what we've been studying in action, which has been great. Like this past semester we've been out to farms pretty much every single day this week for horticultural science, which has been great.
Was it more hands-on than what you expected in terms of field work versus theoretical?
It was different from year to year. So first year you spent a lot more time in the lab doing the practical like practical side of things, like looking down microscopes and things, whereas now in third year we spent a lot more time getting out to properties and actually seeing what we've been studying in action, which has been great. Like this past semester we've been out to farms pretty much every single day this week for horticultural science, which has been great.
And I suppose you would have formed strong industry connections during the last couple of years too. Is that a positive thing for where the course is heading, having those industry connections before you even finish?
Definitely. I mean, being based in the north, we're so close to agriculture, which has been a massive bonus, and we spend a lot of time connecting with growers, as well as lots of our students have also gotten jobs from those experiences as well, heading out on field trips and making those connections as well in industry.
So what's your advice to anyone listening that is potentially looking at a career in ag and might be finishing up year 12?
There's a job in ag for everyone. I personally had no idea at the end of grade 12 that I would be going into agriculture, and agriculture needs people in all areas, whether it be business, research, banking, yeah, lots of different things. So we need those people, and we need more smart young people coming into ag. There's a career for everyone.
I'm Theo Ives. I'm originally from Longford, Tassie. I now live in Launceston with my family. Yeah.
And you've just graduated?
I've just graduated, yep, with a Bachelor of Ag Science, majoring in Sustainable Ag. Yeah, it's been a bit of a journey.
And what have you done alongside that? Have you been working while you've been studying?
Yeah, absolutely. I've had probably a slightly different journey to most people. I sort of left school and didn't know what I wanted to do, and studied full time for the first year, and then yeah, had a few other things going on. So I took a gap year and had a year working as a jackaroo, and that was a good experience.
Where was that?
I worked for Tom Dowling at Mayfield Farms, and then yeah, came back and did a grain harvest and had another crack at uni, and I probably didn't quite have the maturity or the study habits to keep going that year, so then I pulled up stumps again, and then after another 6 months off I came back and finished her off. So yeah.
So what made you persevere then?
I think working jackarooing and driving tractors and fixing stuff made me appreciate the value that education can have, especially in the ag industry, and the opportunities it can provide. And it meant that I didn't have to be, I sort of had to work out the hard way that I had to persevere with that study to mean that I wasn't stuck doing manual labour all day, and you know, I could start exploring a few options that were more aligned with what I was passionate about. Yeah.
And I guess the degree kind of put some business skills behind the science as well.
Oh, for sure. And in terms of gaining respect in the industry, like, I mean, having practical experience to begin with is certainly something that holds you in good stead. A lot of the sort of those growers, they might not know you, but they'll hear your name and know that you've been involved with the practical side of things. So once you finish your study, it sort of allows for those connections to then open up a bit more. And yeah, certainly in terms of gaining respect and stuff, having a bit of background knowledge on how sort of the more practical side of agriculture works is certainly very helpful. And I've sort of learnt to look at the bright side of having multiple cracks at uni, and that's certainly one of them.
What are your job prospects now?
I'm about 3 months into a job working as a field officer at Extract Tas Bioscience as a poppy field officer. So that's been really cool. Learning lots about the sort of agronomy and logistics side of things, and yeah, just managing people and building relationships and yeah, talking to farmers, and that's pretty much the job. Yeah,
you picked a very tough season to start this gig.
Oh, for sure. I mean, yeah, that a lot of the guys have been in the industry for 20 years, and they're saying it's one of the toughest springs that we've ever had, or they've ever had. And yeah, certainly has. But it will build a lot of resilient relationships, and you know, certainly farmers are the most resilient people in the world, but this is a real test. And yeah, hopefully with some gradual increase in warmth and reduced wind, I think yeah, we'll be in good stead.
So what's your advice to anyone listening who's maybe on the fence about what they'd like to do after year 12?
I think if I had my time again, I'd just go out and work out the things that I loved, and you know, really, you know, obviously uni is a tool to really dive into what you're passionate about. But, you know, the uncertainty, I think that if you get out and generate some work ethic. I think especially for our sort of age group where we've gone through COVID and a lot of people's work ethic sort of got lost in that period where we were stuck inside not doing much, and I think I probably had to go back and find my work ethic a bit and sort of almost learn how to learn again. But yeah, if you're not really sure, I think that going out and getting some experience in whatever industry it might be, that those skills will be transferable for the rest of your life. So
how much do you value face-to-face learning as opposed to learning on your computer?
Oh, I mean, as everyone says, becoming a bit of a cliche, like the online stuff is a great resource and a great tool, but actually nothing beats hands-on learning and being able to ask questions face-to-face. And I mean, that's the great thing about the Lonnie degree, like such, especially third year, such a practical degree. And you know, we've got multiple field trips every week and meeting, I mean, it's kind of nice, you meet farmers. It just happened to me the other week, you meet a farmer on a field trip and then 2 weeks later, you know, he's a bloke I'm dealing with at work. So you know, those relationships are vital, especially if people are staying in Tassie, or even if they're not, like those relationships and those borders are broken down for future. And yeah, if people are going to come back to Tassie, yeah.
Well, best of luck for your career in the poppy industry. Hope it's a long one.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Yeah, Theo Ives. And we also heard from Bronte Legros, graduates of the Bachelor of Ag Science degrees at UTAS in Launceston, talking there to our reporter, Larissa Smith. Well, time on a Friday to check the latest on the weather. Michael Conway joins us from the Bureau. G'day, Michael.
G'day, Tony.
Finally got a taste of summer.
Yeah, we have, haven't we? It's getting there. There's many places that are in the low 20s at the moment. Although in the northwest, it's still about 17 or 18 degrees with a bit more cloud there with the onshore winds. But quite warm today. We'll warm up a few more degrees before the maximum temp later this afternoon.
Any rainfall figures anywhere?
No, we haven't had any in the gauges over the 24 hours to 9 a.m. and since.
Okay, now what's the outlook?
Yeah, so a bit of an interesting weather on the weekend, weather a couple of days on the weekend. So tomorrow we get a trough moving over the state, and that will bring some isolated thunderstorms about eastern and northern parts. A bit earlier in the morning, around the north and maybe creeping into the east with some high-based mid-level cloud thunderstorms is possible. So that's of concern for fire starts if that happens, if we get some lightning. And then more surface-based storms in the early afternoon to mid-afternoon through the east. So we'll be watching those closely just to see if there's any fire starts with those. Hopefully not. There is a strong cold front coming through overnight Saturday into Sunday, and that'll initially have northwesterlies in the morning and then becoming westerly throughout, with winds gusting to about 60-80 kilometres an hour throughout most of the state on Sunday. Be quite windy though in the Flinders Island, where we've got extreme fire dangers with night gusting around 90 kilometre hour winds on Sunday.
Okay, and on into Monday?
Yeah, into Monday, west to southwesterlies after the cold front just slowly eased into Monday, and then it starts warming up again through the week as we get a high pressure system developing to our south, and that sort of cradles the warmth in through the week. So a bit of a warmer week ahead.
All right, warnings. What have we got at the moment?
Yeah, just a strong wind warnings for today and tomorrow. So for today, we've got eastern waters from the northern tip of Flinders to southeast Cape, also for the northwest coast. We've got a strong wind warning for eastern, southern and western waters clockwise from the northern tip of Flinders round to Sandy Cape for tomorrow.
And I forgot to ask you the temperatures at the moment, Michael.
Yeah, Hobart, we're at 22, Launceston 22 as well, Devonport 18, Wynyard 18, King Island 21, 29 also at Strawn and Flinders Island, and 20 at St Helens.
Okay, now the coastal waters and swell.
Yeah, we've got generally the winds today, eastern northeasterlies, 15 to 25 knots about the north and the east, and reaching 30 knots at times about the east. Winds variable about the west and south with afternoon sea breezes inshore. Tomorrow we've got north to northeasterlies, 20 to 30 knots about the east in the early morning, and then easing to 10 to 20 about the east during the morning, later in the morning. Elsewhere, winds southwest and northwesterly, 10 to 20 knots. They'll also be increasing about the around the southwest and central west to northwesterly, 20 to 30 later in the evening. For there, the swells about in the west and south for both days, west to southwesterly, 1.5 to 2.5 metres. In the north, there's a westerly up to 1 metre, and in the east, a southerly up to 1 metre. The Wave Rider buoys at the moment, Cape Sorrel 2 metres and Rye Island 0.9 of a metre.
Have you got the maxes there too?
The maximum wave height is at Cape Sorrel's at 3 metres and Maria Island is at 1.4.
Beauty. Thank you, Michael.
Thanks, Tony.
Michael Conway from the Bureau with the latest information for you. We'll talk more about the bomb and the website in just a moment.
Hi, I'm Kylie Baxter, and you know why I love the ABC Giving Tree? When times are tough, the Giving Tree reminds us to look out for each other.
Text Giving Tree to 0438 922 936.
It's the Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Well, continuing with the Bureau of Meteorology, it's unveiled further changes to its controversial new website. The bomb says it had 70 million website visits and over 400,000 items of community feedback on the website, which cost nearly $100 million to build and has been widely criticised since its launch. Speaking on the condition that she was not asked about the cost of the website, senior meteorologist at the bomb, Andrea Peace, walked Warwick Long through the changes.
We have made some changes, as you said, just this week. We've made some changes to the weather map, the radar page, also some other information around forecast or observed temperatures. Just generally tried to make a few changes that we've had some feedback on from the community make some performance improvements and some new features for the community.
Yeah, when you say feedback, a lot of feedback by the looks of it. 400,000 items, is that right?
Well, the last I heard was around 300, but could very well be around 400,000. And, you know, that's fantastic. That is the community speaking and really helping shape the website that they, you know, that they use all the time. So it's great that people are continuing to send in their feedback. And it's helping us prioritise what it is we do next with the website. So we heard a lot of people put in feedback that they were having some trouble with the little indicator where they were on the radar. So now when you log on to the weather map page, which has the radar in it, it was, I think, a black colour. Now it's a nice red colour, so you can really see very clearly where you are. And another thing that we've done is really tried to make the radar and weather page a bit easier to customize. So now when you click on the information around the layers, what you actually want to display on the weather page, you can actually, on the left-hand side now, we've got all of the weather-related information and then the map settings, which used to be on the left-hand side and now on the right-hand side. People were telling us that they weren't really using those so much. What they wanted right where they are sort of looking on the left-hand side is all their weather information. So they wanted to be able to click the rain, they wanted to be able to click wind, they wanted to be able to click the forecast. And that's where you can also select whether you look at the radar and reflectivity or rain rate. We've just really been listening to the community and making those changes to hopefully make it just a little bit easier for them to navigate the new site.
Yeah, but this is probably some of the items that might have fell through the cracks in that initial change in terms of being around the radar and around rain and some of the, rather than just the initial where you are and what weather you're getting, it's bringing in those elements.
Yeah, I think what it's doing is just allowing the community to be even more vocal about what it is that they want from the Bureau's website. So in the past, you clicked on a radar and you had one view. It was just, you know, you couldn't change anything. This is really giving people, I guess, that ability to have their say. You could always send us feedback on the old website, but I think people just were so used to it that they didn't really feel the need to, whereas now they've got this ability to actually really contribute to what it looks like. So it's a great opportunity for everybody.
And maybe they liked the old website too, but change, as we've heard, needs to happen. So are more changes on the way?
Absolutely. So some of the changes that I've talked about today were actually to do with feedback that had come in during the beta phase of the new website, so before we actually launched it. And then some of them are in direct feedback to what we've been hearing since the website has launched. So basically every piece of feedback we're getting, it's going into sort of, I guess, a list with themes. The themes that are coming through really strongly are helping us prioritise what we do next. One of the big things that we did do this time around was because we know everyone loves the radar, and some people were having a little bit of challenge kind of finding it if you hadn't put in a particular location. So we now have a button right on the very front page that you can just click on, just right under Discover Your Weather, which you can't miss. And so you can just now click directly from there to the rain and radar without having to put in a location. So that will help, hopefully help people navigate to there. So you can pop in your location once you get to there, and then that'll zoom in on where you are. So continual improvement. We'll keep everyone updated as new changes do occur.
Yeah, really good information. Thank you for that. Just before I let you go, and as you say, the sort of 300,000 to 400,000 items of feedback, is there any area, like, do you have a breakdown of the area people are most want to see change or most angry about, or can you give us sort of an insight into what a lot of that feedback's about at the moment?
So again, I don't have visibility. I've chosen maybe not to sort of be really delving into all of the different pieces of feedback that we've been getting, but I know that, as I said earlier, there's some of the releases that have happened over the last week have been in response to feedback from during the beta phase, and then some are in response to direct feedback since we've launched in October. So my understanding is that the biggest pieces of feedback have been around the rain radar, not necessarily being able to see their location with their little, the little pointer when you put a location in. So again, that's something that we've responded to immediately. I think there's some questions around the sort of default view, if you like, of the weather map. It's quite a zoomed out view. So I think that's something that I know a lot of people have raised. So in terms of, you know, future changes that might occur, I think that's one that might occur. There may be a change to the default view of the weather map, so it's not so zoomed out, things like that. So yeah, I know that the radar has definitely been up there. Australians love a radar. And so yeah, it's not surprising that there's been a lot of feedback come in about the differences there.
The senior meteorologist Andrea Peace from the Bureau of Meteorology speaking to Warwick Long about the BOM websites. And Jane on the text line says, could BOM maybe ensure the basic features work? There's no 7-day forecast available in Hobart. It doesn't go beyond tomorrow. Thank you, Jane. Well, the federal government finally released its long-awaited response to the review into the Regional Investment Corporation. That's the government's scheme offering low-interest loans to farm businesses to help them become more resilient and respond to drought. As part of the response, the government announced two new loan products, a drought hardship loan of up to $25,000 for farmers affected by drought for at least 24 months, and repayments of the five-year loan will be deferred for the first 2 years. Another new concessional loan will help those impacted by marine harmful algal blooms and marine heatwaves. National Farmers Federation General Manager of Trade and Economics Chris Young says it's vital to get things right.
It's good to see the government respond to the independent review. As you say, that they've had this on their desk for 18 months now, and we, along with our members, have been calling for them to respond to it. It was one of the key asks that we had during the election earlier in the year. We did that because we know how important it is for producers who are facing terrible drought conditions to have the certainty around the RIC.
And I guess that is one of the main things, is there was this sort of uncertainty what happens beyond the middle of next year. Do you feel, or does the NFF feel more comfortable about the future of the RIC and that it is going to continue to be there beyond the middle of next year for farmers to access?
We do. And the review made two central recommendations exactly to that point. The review said concessional lending, so giving farmers the option to access cheaper finance during times of need, is a good policy. And secondly, that the RIC needs to be maintained as the way to get that out across the states. And so, exactly, it was critically important that we saw the government agree to those recommendations. And that's also been supported by the announcement by the Prime Minister in South Australia of an additional $1 billion of funding for the RIC. So that does give us some comfort that the RIC and concessional lending will stay in place, but there's still a lot of work to do. We need to make sure the loans are working for farmers.
And that is, of course, the big question. Is it fit for purpose going forward? What's your initial thoughts on the government's response and the recommendations that it has or has not looked to implement?
Yeah, I think we've seen overall that there's an understanding that the core purpose of the RIC is to give concessional lending so farmers who are in their second, third year of drought can get access to finance cheaper than they can at the banks. And that's what we need to focus on, not just looking in 1 year, but throughout the course of someone's loan, that is serving its core purpose. It was good to see a new product announced yesterday, particularly looking to target and support farmers who are going through extended periods of drought. And it's important now that we work with the government to make sure it does exactly that.
Because, yeah, I think that was one of the recommendations, that there be the shorter-term loan option that really looked at those operating expenses for extended drought rather than in the original loan product. So is that something that you welcome, that new product? Do you see that being usable and workable for farmers?
It's good to see them respond with some new thinking there, because that was one of the messages that the NFF, along with members such as Primary Producers South Australia, had really put to government over the last 12 months, is farmers are constantly planning ahead, some of the best business planners you'll find, but even they, when they're going through 2 years or 3 years of no income, operating at losses, that puts pressure on anyone. And we need to be realistic around the loan products that we put in to make sure we actually give them support.
That's Chris Young, General Manager of Trade and Economics at the National Farmers Federation. He was speaking to Selena Green about the federal government releasing its long-awaited response to the review into the Regional Investment Corporation. Still to come on today's edition of The Country Hour, we meet the world-renowned market gardener from Canada. We'll have a look at the dairy outlook for 2026, and Richard Bailey will be along to check the latest store cattle sale and also what's happening on the mainland markets. First up, the news headlines with Josh Duggan.
Hello, Tony. Students are now returning back to class after teachers and support staff took industrial action this morning over paying conditions. Thousands of educators walked off the job for the second time in 2 months this morning from 9:30, impacting some end-of-year celebrations. The union says the state government's failed to negotiate, but the education department says the 3% pay rise on offer is fair and reasonable. A man wrongly deported from the US to El Salvador has been released from immigration detention following a federal order. Kilmer Abrego Garcia, his release is the latest development since he was wrongfully deported to a prison in his native El Salvador in March before being brought back to the US to face court. He was charged with human trafficking, which he pled not guilty to. The White House says it plans to challenge his release in court. And in sport, Nottingham Forest has boosted its hopes of automatically progressing to soccer's Europa League knockout phase with a 2-1 victory over Dutch club Utrecht. Aston Villa's impressive form continues with a 2-1 victory over Swiss side Basel. It's the club's 8th straight win in all competitions. More news at 1.
Medicine sold like a makeover.
I left that place thinking I found myself a solution.
But it's your body that pays the price.
Something's wrong here. Oh, I never experienced that in my entire life.
Before and After, a new series on how medical hype spreads online. Search for Background Briefing on the ABC Listen app.
Coast to coast, this is The Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Yeah, and on our text line, somebody says the weather forecasts were much better in the 80s and 90s. There you go. Well, inspiration from a famous Tasmanian soil expert has led to a world-famous Canadian market gardener to design a small-scale farm that really works. And in doing so, the Canadian farmer has taught small-scale farmers around the world how to make the most of their farms and make money. I caught up with a small farm pioneer this week at Sandfly Hall during a visit to meet with Tasmanian farmers.
My name is J.M. Fortier. I'm a market gardener. I live and farm in Quebec, Canada. And I'm the author of The Market Gardener Handbook, which is a book about growing your farm from small acreage to success.
And growing up, you weren't a farmer.
No, I was telling the story that I grew up in the suburbs, a regular kind of kid, skateboarding, snowboarding. But I like the outdoors, and I've always loved being outside.
And that's why and how I got into farming, to be outside.
How did you first get into farming? Where did it come from?
Not my parents. My parents weren't farmers. We didn't grow up in a rural setup. My parents weren't hippies or anything like that. Permaculture, certainly not. Regular conventional folks. And I met my wife at university, and we studied ecology and environmental science because I liked the outdoors. After finishing my degree, that we traveled, and then we volunteered to work on a small organic farm, and that was the start of it. We stayed there for 2 years. We learned a lot. We became the manager of another farm. Then we came back home to Quebec, and then we started a market garden on rented land, lived in a teepee. I was sharing that story with everyone today. Then we did that for 2 seasons, and then eventually we bought an old rabbit rundown farm. Not very common here, I think, rabbit barns and rabbit farms. But we did that, and then we just built the farm. And I guess I didn't have a chance to say this here, but if you would say, like, not our claim to fame, but the reason why our farm was successful is because we had land constraint. We had 2 acres, and we needed to grow the farm from within. And that's what we did for many, many, many years.
And you had to make that work.
Yeah, exactly. And we needed to figure out tools, techniques, strategies to grow more vegetables without growing on more land.
A couple of the things you said out there, pretty important. One was make your work meaningful on farm. Mm-hmm. Now, farmers just go about their jobs every day, probably not thinking that way.
Mm-hmm.
But how important is that?
It's very important. The difference between, like, I would say, conventional farming and farmers is that they don't see their customers. But we do. We're market gardeners. We go to market every week, and we see the people that we're feeding. And that kind of feedback is what makes it, you sense that what you're doing has impact, because people are thanking you every week. And that's really, I think, the big difference.
And the other one was the template for the farm, mm-hmm. which came from Tasmania.
Well, I was telling the audience here that, you know, we were really fortunate that when I designed my farm, I had read Bill Mollison, the Permaculture Principle book. Bill Mollison being famous, I hope he has a statue or something here, but he's changed the lives of so many because he was the first one to introduce the idea of design in farming, that your farm is not just a farm. The way it's organized and laid out will have impact on your daily life. So I knew that from reading him, and I organized my farm to be efficient, following his principles, and it had made a huge success on our farm over all these years.
And over all those years, what's the farm looking like now and the scope of the operation?
Mm-hmm. It looks like when we started it, so it hasn't grown. It's still a 2-acre market garden. It has 160 permabeds, which is how we grow. We grow without a tractor. We grow in these permanent beds that are raised and that are 30 meter long. And all these beds are worked with hand tools, broad forks, BCS rotor tillers, hand seeders, push seeders, hand hoes. And we have a whole array of tools that are designed for human scale farming, if you want to say, because it's non-tractor. And the farm, the design and the layout hasn't changed. It has beautified over the years because we've planted trees and shrubs and we've dug ponds and put birdhouses and nests. But it's the same farm, and it's still kicking after all these years. So that's really cool.
And where does the product go?
We sell to 2 farmers market, one on Tuesday, one on Saturday morning. And we have a CSA of 100 families on Wednesday. And we grow salad mix, pre-washed salad mix, for our local grocery store. And that's been pretty much the same families for the last 20 years.
Now, away from the farm, you've become famous worldwide through online social media, the videos.
Yeah.
How many followers have you got?
3 million followers. It's a lot.
It's a lot.
It's a lot, yeah. It's a lot. And social media is this funny thing because you want to be on it, but it's not always... You know, it's not always fantastic to be on it. Like, it comes with a... For me, it's a love-hate relationship.
But it's necessary.
It's necessary today to get the word out. You need to be there, and you need to do certain messages in certain ways. I prefer when I come here and I meet people and I share my story in a real... And I have time. And but writing books also. I wrote quite a few books. My first one is the one that people know me by because it's been... A lot of people have read it, The Market Gardener. And we also have, we had a TV show at one point back home in French. And that was, quite popular also.
When did you get time to work on the farm?
Well, it was filming us doing the work on the farm. So it was actually, it was like a reality show and no one was sleeping with one another and we weren't firing anyone, but they were just, they filmed us for 2 years. People really liked that.
A journalist was the one that helped really get the book out there.
Yeah, I was telling that story of a journalist that had, it's probably going to go down in time as the most famous journalist in our province of Quebec, and more than 1 million people were reading his columns. And he wrote a piece about my book when it came out, and he was mocking me, saying how I was a hippie and an idealistic and who cared about farms and selling vegetables, and in the end said, but you know what, this is really important and you should read the book, it's an amazing read. And that's how my book got started.
And what happened then?
Well, everyone was so excited that they started to buy the book, and because it wasn't supposed to be a popular book, it's a very technical book about how to farm, the prints weren't that many, and then it got back-ordered, and then back-ordered, and then I got invited to different places, and I did media, and eventually I was sharing the story that when it came out again, 6-7 weeks later, everyone went and got their books. So that week it was number 2 in the best-selling list besides 50 Shades of Grey.
Completely different read.
Yeah.
One thing you did say, the movement, the grassroots is so important, and it's the most important movement of our time.
Yeah. I really feel that because it's hard for people to understand, because most people feel that they're well-fed with supermarkets. You know, the abundance is there, it's relatively cheap, but sometimes we don't see the impact on our health of some of that food that's there. You know, buying directly from a local farm, an organic farm, you know, the money stays in the community, it's so empowering, it allows farming to happen. That's really what makes that possible. And I think that the change will happen with the number of farms that are being multiplied. And so it's not about having a few big farms that supply the market. It's about having a lot of small farms that are there. That's how resiliency gets built in. That's how you have more people occupying, you know, the countryside, kids going back to school. And that's the emergence of a new generation of farming, is that they're smaller farms. Because young people, they can't afford big farms. It's too much. And it's complicated. And it's a lot of debt. So when you start in market gardening with just a few acres, not that much machinery, and then you can make a profit and a living, that's exciting for the new generation. They want to do that.
You haven't been to Tasmania for 10 years, but you must feel pretty good about the crowd that's turned up at the hall here today.
Yeah, it was exciting, and yeah, you see there's a lot of young faces too. And that for me is the, you know, I'm growing older now. I'm going to be 47. So I'm not a new grower anymore. I've been doing this for 25 years, and I just feel that it's important to pass down what I've learned. And if they can start from there, like, that's going to be super helpful for everyone.
Well, we appreciate your time on the Tasmanian country, Aaron.
Thank you for coming down yourself. That's fun. Fun to meet you. Thank you.
No, it was great to listen to you.
Thank you.
Yeah, Canadian market gardener and author J.M. Fortier, who visited Tasmania this week to catch up with a number of small-scale market gardeners in the state, had a pretty big day on Tuesday. And I think a lot of the small-scale farmers learnt a few things from him. An amazing bloke. 3 million followers. So, that's a lot. Okay, in just a moment, we'll have a look at the dairy industry and what the 2026 year might bring.
Join the ultimate party this New Year's Eve across the ABC with a massive lineup, including Melanie C, plus the famous Sydney Fireworks, audio described on the ABC Listen app.
Happy New Year!
On ABC TV and iView and the ABC Listen app.
Keeping you updated every day. The Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Don't go away. We've got Richard Bailey coming up for you very shortly with details of that latest and the last store cattle sale at Power Rennie yesterday. First, though, a surge in global dairy production and softer prices is expected to limit the prospect of any increase in the farmgate milk price over the next 6 months. According to Rabobank, Australian milk production is down 2.3%, but some recent rain in key dairy regions could see that trend start to turn around. Michael Harvey, senior analyst with Rabobank, says it's been a mixed year for farmers, with both dry conditions and high inputs leading to a drop in overall production.
Yeah, look, it's been mixed, I would imagine, when you think about
broadly the operating environment. I mean, clearly there's been some seasonal challenges for certain parts of the industry, and, you know, I'm thinking Tasmania, South Australia and Western Victoria being particularly hard hit in terms of dry conditions and what that's done. And broadly speaking then, you know, it's been a high cost of production environment for most dairy farmers around Australia as well. But hopefully things are starting to improve, at least on that front, with, you know, fertiliser prices drifting lower, purchase feed prices have come down. We've had some interest rate relief as well. So, from an operating environment, it's been mixed. And from a pricing perspective, I mean, it's been pretty good against a backdrop of what's going on globally, which is, you know, some deterioration in commodity markets around the world because of, you know, a shift in the fundamentals underpinning the global market, which is obviously leading to, you know, falling milk prices around the world, not rising milk prices, and where we've been immune from that so far this year.
So does it come back to supply and demand when you look at those big global players and a fair bit of milk coming onto the global market?
Exactly. I mean, there's no doubt the velocity of supply growth, which has been coming for a little while now, but the speed has certainly ramped up when you think about the major production regions around the world, you know, the European Union, the US, South Americans, and this part of the world, mainly New Zealand, you know, production is growing year on year in most of these export regions, and the rate of growth is increasing. And it comes down to, you know, what's happening on farm. We are coming out of a cycle where there were higher farm gate prices, margins have been supported by lower feed prices. We haven't had any major weather impacts on dairy production outside of Australia. And, of course, you know, what was dragging production lower this time last year in parts of the US, like in California, there was a bird flu outbreak. In Western Europe, there was a blue tongue virus. So, you know, you're getting recovery from that. So the end result is you're getting global milk production in export regions growing at its fastest rate in a couple of years, and probably just a little bit too much milk for the global market, because there's still some headwinds on the demand side when you think about, you know, performance of major channels and grocery markets for dairy around the world. So that's the underlying fundamentals putting downward pressure on commodity markets.
What does that mean for Australian dairy farmers for, I guess, the rest of this financial year, and I guess what 2026 might look like for them?
Yeah, and that's where the good news is clearly that we're going to avoid any of the downturn in farm gate pricing we're seeing already at the moment. When you think about even over New Zealand, there was a revision down of their midpoint of their payout for Fonterra, I think, last week. We're seeing some pretty rapid declines in farm gate pricing in Europe as well. So milk prices are falling all around the world. We're immune to that because we are locked in until the end of the season, which is a good thing. It's more than, clearly we probably don't think there's much upside in the farm gate price in the current season. And then it becomes a question of what does the market conditions look like when we get around to new season pricing, you know, middle of next year, which, you know, right now, just given where the fundamentals are, you'd be cautious around what it might mean. But there is a bit of time to go through to sort of some water to go under the bridge, I guess, before we get to that point in time, which comes back to, you know, what we are expecting in 2026 is the rate of production growth to moderate around the world, because milk prices are falling. You'll start to cycle high comparables. So we're not expecting, you know, a prolonged expansion of milk production, but we've got a little bit of a hump to get through. So we'll see how markets are looking earlier next year. I mean, just the Australian supply stories, it doesn't impact the global market, but I mean, that's where we are a bit of an outlier here in terms of what's going on with milk production. So I think we're up until the end of October. We've got data and it shows we're now past the seasonal peak and production's down a couple of percent year to date. And that speaks to those dry conditions that are, you know, have been impacting certain production regions. So we are a bit of an outlier in the sense that we don't have a lot of milk supply growth. Hopefully what we do get and is continued improvement in seasonal conditions, because that'll go a long way to ensuring, you know, next year's still a decent year for dairy farmers.
Any other trends you're picking up in the supermarket when it comes to, I guess, the sale of dairy products?
I mean, absolutely. One, I mean, you know, unfortunately, you know, broadly speaking, food inflation is still, you know, it's still quite sticky. And I'll get into the dairy stuff, but if you think about the most recent numbers, you know, food inflation is still over 3%. That's still slightly higher than a long-term average. So that's tells you the story around, you know, the cost of food still rising, not as rising as much as it has in the past, but there's not a lot of deflation. I think where there are some categories that have been causing the most grief, there's relief for consumers. So, you know, we're probably past the worst of it in terms of chocolate prices going higher, egg prices should start to moderate, and even things like cooking oils are starting to drift lower as well. But there'd be a watch on red meat pricing because of what's going on with livestock markets. But that's the broad context. What you're seeing in dairy is, you know, there's not a lot of inflation in the dairy aisle, which is good for consumers. What we might see is some butter price relief coming through because we, obviously in Australia, we import butter. We're a net importer, so we rely on that global butter market to supply the domestic market. So, you know, global butter prices are dropping quite quickly, so that should hit consumers at some stage. But outside of that, I mean, the broad trend clearly is, you know, the high protein boom is alive and well. And, you know, that's a US story, but it's certainly alive and well here. And I think some commentary from people in the market was saying, you know, it's a double digit sort of growth rate for high protein dairy products. There's actually some supply chain constraints to try and keep up with demand. So I think that's a really positive story for dairy.
Yeah, that's Michael Harvey, senior analyst with Rabobank, speaking to Josh Becker about the dairy sector at the moment and heading into 2026. All right, store cattle sale at Parani yesterday, so let's find out how things went with our livestock reporter, Richard Bailey. How are you going, Richard?
Yeah, going well, Tony. Going very well. Beautiful little bit of weather we're having. Nice bit of warm for a change.
Oh, isn't it fantastic? It's wonderful. Now, the store cattle sale, how did it go?
Just shy of 1,100 cattle. Not as much breed as last sale, more sort of crossbreedy type cattle, but just about all the cattle were shining. They were prime and right ready to go for the next people to take them on. Market was pretty strong right through. The best of the yearling steers, 1960 to the top of 2600, they averaged around 460 cents a kilo. Now, quite a few of those better bred cattle made 500 cents, but the crossies brought them back to around about that sort of level. The middle range ones, 1420 to $2,060 a head, averaging just shy of 500 cents. And obviously, if they're averaging that, the best of the ones are making over 500. And then your lighter cattle, 1300 to 1840. Now, there were basically no or very, very few cattle, those really little cattle under 200 kilos. So these lighter cattle sort of averaged anywhere from sort of 560 to 570 cents a kilo. And obviously there were odd pens that made 600 cents or thereabouts. The steers sold very well. Heifer proportion, they went well too. Best heifers, 1680 to 2400 to average 440. Middle range, 1540 to 1820 to average the same. And then lighter, 1120 to 1600 to average 485. So there were plenty of heifers that did nudge 500 cents or thereabouts. There were just a few very light pens that got down to $1,000, but it took a very small calf to get down to that. There were 33 cows and calves. These sold exceptionally well. There were some good cows and calves in them, but the vast majority made 2,000 to 2,000. To 2,800, just a few dairy types, 1,600 to 2,000. So very, very good day over at Parana yesterday. That's the last of the store sales for the year. And I would think that the numbers have probably been up, particularly during the spring period over the last 3 months.
Yeah, and all indications are that the beef market's going along pretty well and should stay that way for a while.
Yeah, I think it depends who you talk to a bit. I think a lot of it depends on seasons in New South Wales and Queensland. A lot of New South Wales has suddenly got very dry, and so a lot of those guys are offloading cattle. You know, some of the yardings at places like Dubbo are huge for this time of the year. I think I wrote a story during the week or last week. Most of the numbers are up sort of 15 to 20% through the sale yards. So there's an indication there. And obviously, rains in Queensland at this time of the year and going on, they say there's some rain forecast around Christmas in Queensland, so that'll be good. The good news out of that all is that the Victorian season has turned out a reasonably late spring, but a good spring. So hopefully for their weaner sales coming up in early January, that'll stay pretty consistent.
Okay. Any more cattle news from the mainland?
Yeah, no, not really. Just most cattle yards in this last week, most prices came back 20 or 30 cents a kilo, purely on the back of numbers. And yesterday at Mortlake, there was a big store cattle sale, 5,500, and they quoted that 20 to 40 cents cheaper. still pretty good. And, you know, as I said, for the reasons that there's not much interstate competition from north coming into those markets at the moment. So, look, it's sailing along pretty well.
Okay, Richard, now lamb and sheep, what's happening there?
Yeah, same, going pretty well. In fact, given the numbers that in Western Victoria at the moment, I would have thought most people would be surprisingly pleased with the way that the market has stayed up. You can run a line through 1,050 to 1,150 cents a kilo on all good quality new season's lambs. If they've become a bit woolly and drying off, they do drop down to, you know, 1,000 cents or 1,050 cents, but still very, very good. You know, we've never seen money like this at this time of the year. In fact, probably most times of the year, to be honest. So that's been terrific. You know, we're in a situation where I think in two sales this week, Hamilton yarded over 70,000 and there were 30,000 at Ballarat. So numbers are good there. They started to drop off up north a little bit, Bendigo a few less. But it'll just be interesting. There's a, like we reported on Wednesday, that store lamb sale on the screen on Tuesday night just shows how much confidence there is in the industry. So if people are prepared to sort of pay, you know, $170, $180 and up to $200 for lambs to go back to the paddock, you know, they've obviously got some confidence about them. So that's really good. Mutton market is extremely good at the moment. Most mutton markets in Victoria and New South Wales, you can run a line through 750 to 800 cents a kilo. And this time last year, that was about the lamb price. So that gives you an indication that things are very, very strong there. It means there's a huge number of sheep making between $140 and $200 a head. And then your heavy sheep are making well above that, obviously.
Now, the important thing is I've got a couple of tomatoes appearing.
Well, we had a bit of a discussion on a few things like that yesterday in the sale yard, and a lot of people were saying that their tomatoes are pretty average, and I don't know, but I've got broad beans that are quite high, but I don't think there's many beans on them. Anyway, I might be wrong, but we'll wait and see over the next couple of weeks.
They're good at hiding, the pods.
Are they? Yeah. Well, gee, I don't know. Yeah. And I did hear that you actually interviewed the legendary Harley Taylor a couple of weeks ago, and
I did.
He was complaining his tomatoes weren't that flash.
Yeah, he was going to go supermarket way, but anyway. All right, Richard, you have a great weekend.
Good on you, Tony.
Yeah, Richard Bailey back with us next Wednesday to check the latest weekly cattle sale at Parramatta on the Country Hour. Have a happy and safe weekend and another Country Hour after midday on Monday.